Welcome back to the Disaster Podcast here in Washington, D.C. Again, we want to thank our partners, the GEMS Corporation in Penwell, and certainly Physio Control for sponsoring our booth. We're going to reintroduce my partners here and my good friend Andy, Dr. Joe.
Joe Holly, EMS physician and USAR physician.
Jim Logan, firefighter paramedic, officer with Memphis Fire Department, co-owner of Paragon Medical Education Group.
Andy Swartz, I'm a registered nurse, ex-paramedic, captain EMS coordinator with San Ramon Valley Fire, and deputy commander for the Disaster Medical Assistance Team, California 6 in San Francisco.
You can never be an ex-paramedic.
That's right.
I've actually...
No such thing.
Well, I are
been
one.
Been a paramedic twice.
There you go. All
right. I am still a paramedic and have been for a very long time. I work with the Livermore Pleasanton Fire Department. I want to thank my chief for letting me be here. I'm also a member of DMAT CA6. I'm the training officer. So we're going to actually be talking about that. In a previous discussion, we were talking about why we should not self-deploy and the problems that creates. So we got into a little bit discussion about some of the teams that people can join and how they're different. You have your citizens, and we have to be careful about the alphabet soup here. Jim's reminding us when we haven't defined a term. So we have a Citizens Emergency Response Team, which is a CERT, your Medical Reserve Corps, which are medical people that just want to be available in case of a larger incident where they may be needed. Some states have state teams that sometimes there's a crossover between the personnel and the federal and the state teams. But we want to talk about USAR. We talked about DMAT, which is a whole different banana. And IRCT, and we'll define all these terms for you. So Joe, why don't you guys tell us a little bit about, if someone's interested in becoming a member of USAR, what is it, what's involved, what kind of, what do you need to know to be involved in USAR?
Well, I think there's a tremendous amount of stuff involved with that on lots of different levels, and I think one of the pluses to things like Medical Reserve Corps and CERT teams, et cetera, is it's a nice introductory way to appreciate everything from the broadness of knowledge that you need to have, how to be safe in a very unsafe environment, and concepts of command and control and management and how things have to work in those situations. So it provides you some structure. And it's a great introduction into higher level disaster response. At the USAR level for FEMA, the entry requirements are.
So what is it? Let's make sure we define USAR. I don't think.
I'm sorry. So for a federal level urban search and rescue team, which is about a 250 person organization, that's made up of not only sort of pre-hospital medical providers, but physicians, et cetera, as well, but also a tremendous variety of other folks, from rescue folks to civilian engineers to dog teams to communication specialists, finance specialists, technical information folks, mapping folks, command and control. It just goes on and on and on. The point behind that being that this entire discussion of disaster response is not necessarily just a medical issue. There are many, many, many other roles for many other people. If you have an interest in doing that, there is a role for you somewhere. There are so many jobs that have to be done to make things happen that there's something for everybody. Having said that, the preliminary points to getting on a federal level search and rescue team are primarily designed around two things. One is for us, we become part-time employees of the federal government, FEMA, when we are deployed. That's great. That provides us with insurance and licensure, capability to practice medicine in a different state and all that sort of stuff. So that part's very important. Obviously, a lot of hoops to jump through to work for the government. But the other part of that, excuse me, is really a variety of classes that are about your own personal safety. And many of those classes, for example, for a medical provider, may well be at the awareness level. You need to understand rope rescue and water rescue and these other very specialized areas that are very dangerous and have a lot of technical equipment involved in them, and lots of bad things could be going on there, and the last thing you want to do is put yourself in that environment and get hurt and not be able to take care of the patient. That also includes, on the medical side of things, specific medical education for the very unique environment and very unique set of issues that we often see in disaster medicine, and that better prepares us for that. But also part of that role is taking care of the team. We take care of the dogs, so we have to have a little veterinary medicine. We have to take care of hygiene issues, public health-based issues, environmental disease issues. It's a very broad set of problems. So those classes are designed to prepare you for that and have you be safe when you're in that environment.
That's the key point. So, Jim, you're an EMS specialist with the team. What's your role?
Medical specialist, yes. So there's, with each 72-member team, that's how many we travel with, like Joe said, from engineers to civilian engineers to people in broadcast, news that are information specialists. But for us in particular, I think it's a 4 or 5-member team, depending on what our role is, our mission is that day, or that deployment. Basically, to take care of the team. We can take care of 10 critical patients and about 20 non-critical. But for the most part, you're taking care, it's foot care. It's not, let's go back to this EMS thing for a second. It's not glamour, like they tell you it's going to be in school, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're taking care of a lot of
television.
Right,
and
television. You're taking care of a lot of feet, right? Because you're in the boots forever. You're taking care of a lot of aches and pains and sprains and tears. Right, and so, yeah, exactly. and colds. I remember we almost were sequestered at the Salt Lake City Olympics due to an illness that ran through our team.
Uh-oh.
So
yeah.
We had the responsibility of doing clinical medicine, right, for things like that. Be it our team or if we're the first team set up, FEMA may say, we tag you guys to take care of this whole base of operations, which at Katrina was 3,000 members. So we had a clinic that worked 24/7, along with our operations out in the field, taking care of patients and taking care of our crew there. Our mission is pretty much what we do at home, but expanded a little bit when we go out. We've got all kinds of equipment that we use. We take all that with us. So we show up, right, shortly after the incident. We go out 4 to 6 hours after, so we're packed up, ready to go. Our tractor trailers hit the road. We work for normally, I think our deployments usually are like 11 to 14 days, something like that. And then DMAT's there. They,
what a great segue.
Kind of come
I was
in.
Hoping
and,
you would go
I'm
there.
Working with you here. They come in and kind of take over. So we're the pre-hospital part of medicine during a disaster, and you are the hospital part.
Beautiful segue. So Andy, I'm going to let you explain where those patients go. What's a DMAT? What do we do? How are we configured?
Well, I think Joe, I could take some of the information that Joe said and you said regarding USAR and preparation. DMATs, again, we're mainly volunteers.
Disaster Medical Assistance Team.
but intermittent federal employees, just like the USAR. So a lot of the training that we go through and is volunteer until we're called up to respond to something. And aside from a disaster, we sometimes pre-deploy for national security events. In case something happens, we can be utilized to backfill hospitals that are impacted. And typically a team will deploy with 50 personnel and be self-sufficient for up to 72 hours. We, again, like you, we have physicians, nurses, paramedics, EMTs, logistics people, communications people that are necessary to work in that environment. We're pretty much self-sustaining, at least initially. But then we, like you, have incident command teams, you know, that come in and resupply us. But it takes about a year. We do training. Getting through the, as you know, the federal paperwork and stuff takes some time.
Oh,
so
yes.
We initiate some of the training. We do some things locally as well. We can respond to state incidents. So we have surgical teams. We have
the broader. We're under the National Disaster Medical System, which is inclusive of surgical teams, pediatric specialists. I mean, it's a whole
thing. The acronym for that is NDMS.
Yeah.
NDMS.
Yeah. Vaccination teams. There's you know, pediatric specialists or so. But typically, a disaster medical assistance team will deploy with about 50 people.
And you get to sleep in tents with 50 of your
Always hear
your new best friends.
There's the snoring tent and there's the non-snoring
tent.
Not true. There is no non-snoring tent. You know, they're all snoring.
That's good.
Yeah, so bring ear protection. That's right. You know, for at night. So, Joe, what was one of your more memorable deployments, and what were the what are the things you walk away? You know, I think the key question in my mind that I can't even answer is, why do we do this? And then once we've done it, why do we keep going back? What's something memorable about one of the deployments you've been on?
Oh, my gosh. They're all memorable.
I know there's so many.
Yeah, they're all memorable in some different way. You know, obviously the profound ones are the impacts
high profile.
High profile, greater significance, et cetera. So, you know, I can certainly remember, you know, pulling up to the Pentagon with the smoke boiling out of the place and sort of standing there going, what the hell's going on here? And what's going to happen next? And just that entire sense of anticipation and concern and what are we going to find and where's it going to go? And exactly. Just sort of that, which direction is this going to take things in? And, you know, I think part of the other thing that was interesting about that deployment was that was one that, to me, was profoundly immersive. The entire team was sequestered is not the right word, but under very tight security for obvious reasons. We were working in a top secret location with top secret stuff everywhere and concerns of threats to our safety and all that sort of stuff. And that was pretty profound. And I remember clearly after two or three days, we literally had to start putting the date up on the board in the middle of the common area to sort of know what day is this.
You do lose track of time.
You totally do. You just totally free. They just sort of run into another because, you know, the work day was 24 hours long and we were going pretty continuously there for a couple of days. So you very rapidly get completely disoriented from time and then sort of that challenge of catching up on what else is going on in the world and, there was other incidences happening and, you know, that whole response after that.
And what is going to happen next? We're out on the West Coast.
Yeah, one of the members of our team, a pastor, coined the term, it's a terrible honor to
participate.
That's
the one I was trying to think of. Yeah,
that's great. Well, I like that.
It hits the nail on the head right there.
So
it
that's
was.
Why we do it.
And that's a good point, and I want to tag onto that, Andy, that we talked about people were so obsessed with going there, with being part of that. And as scary as it was to go there, we felt so honored to be that all of our training and all of the time we'd put into being a good team member culminated in that moment to being honored with being able to deploy there. And we all walked away different people. And I think that's a little point I'd like to make too. We do change a little bit.
We leave a little piece of ourselves at each time we're deployed. And, you know, we take a lot there, but we leave a little bit of ourself there in that history of disasters.
Well, most of us are, you know, work, you know, as a paramedic firefighter, are used to working kind of as a team, you know, and you develop that relationship. But there's something unique about if you're on a USAR team or a DMAT team where, you know, maybe normally work together, but the bonding and stuff that
goes it's hard to
explain to people. Sometimes.
It is indeed.
It's a brotherhood in a brotherhood, right, if you will.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, on
or
that
sisterhood,
note,
I'm sorry.
Thank you. But it was interesting. We were together on September 11th, and that's right. When we were discussing doing this podcast. And I didn't talk about our experience. You can't even talk about this to other EMS people. because I don't get it. And then I realized, Joe and I were talking, we went to dinner, and he had been to the Pentagon, and it was like this immediate bonding that we were able to sit down and talk to each other, and that was just really cathartic. Jim, what's your what experience do you remember?
Really?
Most? Like, I know the answer.
Gosh, there's so many lessons learned.
You have done a lot of that.
Not any more or less than you guys have, but just you guys know there's just so many lessons learned about, one, how to take care of people better. In EMS and the fire service, we take care of people at their worst moment. With disaster medicine, we take care of people in their very, very, very worst moment, including their entire community. I mean, it's not just them that's affected, it's their entire community. And we take care of our team. There's a lot of things with that puts things in perspective, I guess, for you, and really makes you, I think that's what it does, really. I've been looking for the answer to the question, why do we keep doing this? And I think that may be because it brings more clarity to what we do, why we do what we do. I remember after a couple, we keep talking about the Pentagon, but that's, that was national significance. We'll talk about other things later, but one thing that really stuck with me is we were they had established this area, I can't remember what it was, City of Hope or something like that, where they had, the Red Cross was there, mm-hmm. Everything was there, they had food, everything. So I was standing there, and we had this common area where we ate dinner, and the kid just started sending cards in, and you couldn't even look at that because you just fall to pieces.
I remember them.
But I was about
Trinity Church.
Yeah, exactly. So I remember kind of just, take my plate and put it in the trash and just kind of sign, and I got decom, but I'm still dirty, right? And this tall guy, about 6'4", with a crew cut, he's in civilian clothes, and he comes up to me and he says, "Tough day, son?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Could be worse, though, right?"
Wow.
I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you see that file cabinet right up there?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "That's my office. I lost every member of my team, my office staff."
And these people still carry on?
Yeah, and they came back to help, right?
Yeah. So. And by that description, he means the file cabinet hanging out what's left of the third floor office.
Yeah, it's a picture you see every day. So it just brings things into perspective. And I think that's why we keep coming back and doing what we do, because it is meaningful. When we were there, it was mostly a recovery mission because of what had happened. In our part, because initially, the first responders took very great care of the patients and got them out and got them to where they needed to go. But that helped bring the recovery part, helped bring closure. So every night when we got out, we walked out up in the hill, you could see the family members with the candles, waiting for that closure. So those are some memorable moments. Katrina was more of a humanitarian effort, more of a medical mission, if you will. So mm-hmm. These disasters can be totally different when you go
absolutely.
To them.
Each with their own challenge.
That's right.
Well, I think that sort of ties it back to EMS. That saying of you've seen one EMS system, you've seen one EMS system. You've been on one disaster, you've seen one disaster. They are all different.
There's common elements to it, right? But they're all different.
Yeah, they are all different.
Disaster is the only one.
Yeah, and when you think you've seen and done everything.
You haven't been on the next one yet.
Right.
Well, it's funny in the USAR system because, we're very aggressively attempting to learn from what we did last time and how we make it better. And it's, I remember one sort of funny saying that came out of that, which is, at the time we had, our focus had been much more on collapse structure, et cetera, not so much on water rescue and that kind of stuff. And it's kind of like, hi, we're USAR, we don't do water rescue, now get in the boat. And it was just this kind of, now we're doing water rescue, of course now we're trying to carry boats and all them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's just, the mission is always different. And it goes back to me, I think for me, one of the things that makes it so personally satisfying is it's always a challenge. It's never the same thing it was last time. And it's always, a test mentally to adapt and overcome and improvise and make a bad situation work the way you want it to work.
Andy, for us, I'm sure it was ground zero, just like it was the Pentagon for them.
Yeah, well, Sam and I are you know, will be forever bonded because of an incident. And I knew Sam before this, and it's one of the reasons why we were at Ground Zero. Much like you, it was a recovery effort. And I remember coming back and the incident commander saying, grab a paramedic, they're waiting for you in the pit. And I'm like, what's going on? Just grab a paramedic.
Guess who that was.
And remember going up 80 feet into the pile and then down 40 feet into the pit. And as we're walking down, you realize there's not a plastic, a piece of wood, anything that's recognizable. No mouse, no computer part. It's just
paper and rebar.
The cement, rebar, and we were there.
And dust.
And dust.
Oh my God, yes.
And we were literally there to watch five firefighters, five police officers go into this burning, smoking hole in the ground. And I would even lose sight of Sam, who was standing 6 feet away from me because of what was coming out. And what struck me, we were going to put our rescue bags down on the ground. And the teams that were there literally said, don't do that. And they turned over their buckets of equipment so that we wouldn't dirty our bags on the ground. That was what it was. And just realizing them going in, you know.
And they disappear in this
Wall. And then they'd come back covered in dust and soot. And the only way you could recognize fire from police was the police still had their guns with them.
It was really surreal. I mean, Andy and I, we had double filter respirators on, and we were so geared up you couldn't see an inch of skin on our bodies, but we were almost reading each other's minds and just looking at each other and going, we are in the deepest, darkest, most infamous place in the entire
planet. I likened it to hell on Earth at that point.
And, and for us, I mean, we worked in two tents adjacent to the pile, but the pile was sacred ground. Nobody went there. So when our commander says, okay, gear up, you're going out there, we went out there. That's the way all the New Yorkers were discussing Ground Zero. It's out there. That's what it is. And it was just a surreal experience. And then when they didn't get what they were looking for, so they finally gave up. And I still remember this, where the firefighters in single file, they just walked up the berm, and for some reason, they lined up on the other side.
They just lined up.
Yeah. And you know, the kind of light banks of lights they have in stadiums were backlighting them. Then you have all this dust. And Andy, I'm getting chills right now. Looked at
me
Andy,
too.
And we both read each other's minds. We got to remember what this looks like. Because it was almost like they were sad that they didn't achieve their goal.
Sure.
And we could see that in their faces. But this backlight and
those are really profound.
We were fortunate that none of the rescuers were injured in this. It was a very precarious void. That's why we're there, you know, and stuff. None of them came out injured, but I know the fact of what they were breathing.
Physically
and the
injured.
Dust and stuff.
They weren't acutely injured, but they were probably chronically injured.
And to this day, I wonder how many of them are still with us, you know.
Yeah,
I agree.
It would be sad to know that. Well, we got a few minutes. We were talking about how do you get on a team. There's really an importance in training. And it's not just, you know, we were talking a little bit, how much of this is hurry up and wait? I mean, how often do we deploy? What, every 5 years?
Well, it depends. You know, we're kind of strange that way. We all want something.
We're kind of strange for doing this at all.
We want to see horizontal palm trees, you know.
And we don't admit that, though, usually.
Go into those situations. they don't occur, but there's opportunities, training opportunities, and trying to work at the local level. And so, you know, doing some of the training, some of the preparedness, like, you know, for equipment and stuff, takes some time. So it's kind of a barometer for us. I mean, you really find out the people are committed are the ones who make that sacrifice, even though they haven't deployed on a mission yet. And part of what we hope to do is we always have you know, a core group of people that go all the time, are always available, and you need those, but you also want to have some of those new people along so,
yeah,
so
sure.
they get the opportunity.
And I think that that's part of the issue with disasters in general is they are episodic by nature.
Right.
And, you know, it's sometimes hard to keep people motivated, especially for an event that may or may not happen. And I think, you know, that core group of people you're talking about are the ones that, you know, manage to stay engaged and know that it might be a year before anything happens. But you know, just watching your two faces in the discussion we just had, those events are life-altering and
Absolutely.
So profound that that volunteer time you spent training before that deployment is nothing. It's totally worth the cost.
I guess that explains why we go back.
Exactly right.
I think we've answered that question.
I think we have finally answered that question.
So we can stop now. We're done with the podcast forever after that?
Yeah.
That question.
Well, we're going to keep talking about that. But there's ongoing training. And we train quarterly. We have a full day because our people live all over the place. And they come in. And you've got to be at the top of your game. When that call comes in, you're never going to know when it's going to come in.
You're
and
right.
you have to be ready to go. We were talking, Jamie was talking to us yesterday about being prepared. Mm-hmm. Our bags are always packed.
Mm-hmm.
Always packed. We go in and we revise things and freshen things up or add things, but it's always packed.
I have to just say, one deployment I didn't go on, you know, and it was probably the most frustrating for me,
right.
more than
I remember
any
that.
One. I was literally told to stay by the phone. We're going to get you out 12 hours, and I'd be pacing.
Mm.
I probably would not get 4 feet away from any phone in my house, you know. And
as you watch the news.
And
yeah,
I watched the news,
yeah.
and the first 12 hours went by, and then the second 12 hours went by, and they said, we're having trouble getting you out there, and then I finally didn't go.
I didn't go.
And
it makes you
it
crazy.
Was
yeah.
probably
yeah.
one of the hardest things for me to get over.
I've had
it's
that exact
going.
Same experience, and I, you know, it's as profound as having been there. I'm missing that one, and I can't stand it.
And we finally recognize that, yeah. because not everybody on a team can go. We're concerned about, you know, the people that go, their
sure.
mental well-being and
mm-hmm.
stuff, but you also have to be aware of your other team members who
sure.
who aren't able to go.
And that may be a subject we're talking about
right.
later. So, you know,
yes.
how is the team structured to allow people to go and,
right.
and to realize that some folks aren't available right.
right
away and that life happens to people and sometimes they can't make it. And the team itself has to have mechanisms in place to be able to fill your role.
And when you touch, you know, there's roles for our team members at home that don't
Absolutely.
Go on.
And
oh,
that's
a whole
phenomenal.
Different subject.
Right.
But let's wrap this up talking about training and the hurry up and wait. But that's what you guys do with Paragon. And you really try to prepare these kinds of people as well as all the rest of us. And I don't think Andy really knows a whole lot about what you do. So why don't
I'm going to find out pretty
why
quick.
Why don't you tell
Good.
Them?
Yeah, so from our lessons learned, from these deployments, from our background in emergency medicine and disasters, Joe and I came up with a concept of education that involves a lot of innovative products that are out on the market, innovative ideas, but most importantly, not death by PowerPoint, right? As you train with some of these classes, those classes are great, but I think that we learn so much more when we are in a practical environment as adults. In disaster and emergency medicine, we learn even better when we're put in those high-stress environments in immersion. And so that's what we bring to the table. We recreate those with audio, visual stimulation and putting the providers through the paces.
The way today's providers learn.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not death by PowerPoint.
Yeah.
Well, the idea is to make that educational training experience as profound as one of those deployments and where it's incredibly memorable and people come out of there saying, you know, wow, best stuff I've done in my entire 25 years.
And it's not a exercise or a drill because, you know, we're thrown out there in a drill environment or exercise environment. Most of us can commit maybe an hour to that. And then you're evaluated that, you know, oh, we found out that we suck, you know, at what we do. Well, that's because you didn't have the education on the front
exactly.
end before you drilled, right? So that's what we try to do. We make it not a drill, but all right, let's think about this, you know, it's kind of a combine.
I think one of the things that you do is, and we've all seen probably hundreds of mass casualty incident plans and participated in that. And over the years, my philosophy has changed in that, look, you just get the people who have the experience, the training, get their heads together, look at the options, see what resources you have, mm-hmm. and make decisions.
Absolutely right.
So where can we find out more information about Paragon if they were interested in learning that? Jeff?
Well, Paragon's on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com, and we have a Facebook page by the same name. And our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU.
At ParagonMed.
At, thank you, at ParagonMed.
I think they would do that.
Well, we don't tweet very much, so we're all new to this tweeting thing.
You will be learning.
I know, right? Welcome to social media.
Exactly.
And Andy, where would you think we should send people to learn about DMAT?
Well, you could probably just Google NDMS, National Disaster Medical System. Our website, dmatca6.org, has links to other places. But, I mean, same thing, you would probably look under Urban Search and Rescue and,
sure.
and find...
Yeah, I think the great Google will right. find your state... team somewhere.
Right. And then same thing, Medical Reserve Corps, if that's something that interests you.
Google it.
Contact your local fire department or EMS agency, see if there's a CERT program or something similar in your community you can get involved in. I mean, there are non-governmental organizations. Even hospitals are developing response teams.
We didn't even crack the surface on
stuff.
All the options.
Right.
Absolutely. But the nice thing about CERT teams is almost always they'll come provide that training
right.
to you if you just ask at
and that's
no
a
charge.
Good place to start.
It's a great class.
And then you get
class.
A sense of, you know, if that's what you want to do.
Absolutely.
We have our brand new website, which we are obviously have a lot of things to develop. But as we talk about things, we'll put these links also on our website and our show notes. And that is disasterpodcast.com. And unfortunately, as much as I'm enjoying this discussion, we do have to wrap this up because other people want a podcast.
Wow.
So, but we're going to have a lot of information for you. Again, please go to the site. Let us know what you think about what we've discussed so far. We'd love to have your ideas on what you would like to learn about because there's so much information. And we want to thank GEMS and the Kenwell Corporation for having us here at EMS today, and certainly the Physio Control folks for sponsoring our podcast here. And the last thought is, this is not your everyday medicine. Hope to see you soon.